¿Usted no dejó la mesa? Where do you want to come up from?
I'm on fire.
Eh? You want to fire from that anger?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right, members, I think we need to settle down.
Just some housekeeping arrangements. The first is we've got Mr. Zola Fidlani scheduled for today. The staff has had a real difficult time trying to contact him. Phone has been off for quite some time. They sent him emails. They booked his ticket for today. And we got a cryptic message from him on the 9th, which is this morning, which says, I'm traveling and will only be back on Thursday. This is 9th. This is yesterday. Oh, it's been printed today. So we got a message from him on yesterday, which only says, I'm traveling and will only be back on Thursday. And I know they've been in touch with him since last week trying to get him, and he says he's a very flexible person, etc. But then we get a message like this. So we might have to take a decision on this matter because he's scheduled for interview today. Arrangements have been made for him, and this might be a bit of a problem for us. So that's the first one. Shall we dispense with it? What is our attitude about this matter?
Now my viewpoint is, Mr. Chairperson, he said he was available for today. There was arrangements made for him to be here today, and I think if you miss the bus, you miss the bus. Now I'm very sorry for him, but to put extra pressure on us to move him to Thursday or what other day, I don't think it's fair.
Let me first just get a formal report from the staff, because I might not be presenting what has actually done. But Nolitando, can you just tell us what has happened with Zola Fidlani? Okay. Lugo, can you just come and give us an explanation what happened? You've been interacting with this person.
Thank you very much. What happened, I did try to phone Mr. Fidlani. I think it was Thursday last week. He said to me, he is available. He's a flexible person. He won't be even complain if he is given any particular day. So yesterday what happened, he is just sending me an email saying that I will be traveling, and he didn't indicate to me from where he will be traveling. Then he said, I will be traveling, then I will be back on Thursday.
What time on Thursday?
No, he didn't indicate any time on Thursday when she would be.
Mr.
Maybe what we need to do, check just to put this matter aside and request the staff to just get a hold of him in terms of Thursday. What time Thursday and when Thursday? Because Thursday, I understand, is still the day for the interview. And we have shortlisted this person based on the skill which we have identified from this person. So if he's still available within the days of the interview, my view tells me that we need to accommodate him on the day, if still within the 3 days of the interviews. But maybe if administrative can deal with that matter and check that final day for the interview is Thursday, so that person may become available.
There's a proposal. No story.
I don't know whether I'm sitting at the right place. Yeah, I think I am seconding the view that has been expressed by Honorable Coran. I think it's a correct because this person has been selected, and it's not like we are getting out of the way. On Thursday, we are still dealing with interviews, and then we can reschedule. All right, come.
Excuse me.
Chairperson, I actually wanted to suggest that we do that, but that we perhaps look to see if we then can't ask one of those scheduled for Thursday to move up to perhaps tomorrow, because we will have two slots which the committee will still decide on of two candidates that can no longer be coming for the shortlisting, as you are informed. So we must just bear in mind that we must still consider that issue as well, so that we can perhaps just ask and see, is it possible to, is there anybody else which is, who would perhaps be in a position to come in earlier, either late today or tomorrow?
Okay, that's a scheduling matter. So we are agreeing that we will give this person an opportunity to come in either tomorrow or Thursday, but after Thursday, we will not be scheduling any interviews. Lugo, will you follow up on this matter, please? Thank you. This matter is then over. Then there's the second matter. We've got this correspondence from the Save Our SADC Coalition. I think the letter has been circulated. They are requesting that all the CVs be placed on the parliamentary website. They want the reasons for the decision of the committee, on what basis it selected the 31 persons that have been candidates. They're also requesting that once the final names of 12 names have been finalized, they want an opportunity to come and talk to Parliament about those names. And they've got a set of questions that you might want to consider asking the candidates today. I did indicate to them, and a number of journalists have also been asking for the CVs, and I said, look, that will be a committee decision. It will not be my decision entirely. So I put it to the House, what is our approach to the idea, first of all, of releasing the CVs?
I would suggest that we do release the CVs at this stage. I think that it's the ones that we that have been shortlisted, that we put them, I think there's a huge public interest in this process, and I don't see any reason that we should not disclose the CVs. I think we need to be transparent. They obviously, as I say, there's a huge public interest in the matter, and I think that it would help with the transparency of the whole process. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Killian?
Thank you, Chair. I would support that, that we are absolutely transparent with our process. And secondly, I would also like to suggest that we, in fact, receive copies of those questions that the Coalition and anybody else would like us to pose to candidates, so that we can make sure that we're going through the process with absolute maximum input. Thank you, Chief.
Mr. Kulwani?
You see, Chair, we don't have a fundamental problem with releasing of CVs. But we have a slightly problem, Chair, if you look at the media today. The business day to day, they are discussing some of the candidates. Now, Chair, we don't know what informed that article. We start to discuss and label some of the candidates even before they come before this committee for an interview. I think that is bad, Chair, as the first issue. Secondly, Chair, is that our view was that indeed, Chair, we need to release the CV. But following what is happening now, Chair, where people have been just labeled and be described and be associated in the media before even they come before this committee, Chair, I would think that as a normal process, when the candidate comes in here, we also ask them in terms briefly to discuss their CVs normally. Then they go through their CVs, Chair. I would think that after the candidate has been interviewed, then the CVs be released, Chair. Because this public onslaught, we are not sure where it's coming from and where it's going to. I would think, Chair, I would propose that as the person comes here, after he's been interviewed, then those CVs be posted to the website, as already have come here, because normally they are also asked to be go brief to their CVs, and that this process is also a public process, Chair. It's not different from posting the CVs. People who got their interest in this process, this is a public process, they can also follow the process here. But this thing of labeling people through the media, Chair, and so on, and just posting CVs, I think That's our problem, say, which we're having currently about just giving the CVs under these conditions, things are happening. We support that, say, after the person is interviewed, then the CV is posted to the meet. But after the interview of that person, I think we need also to protect these people, not just to allow them to be dealt with by the media the way things are going now. Thank you.
Other views?
Thank you, Chairperson. I heard what the Honourable Kulwani said, but I hope he doesn't mean insinuated that the FAST and some of the opposition parties leaked information to the media. So I just want to put that absolutely straight. But I think it is an open process. There's the media sitting, they are listening what we ask. They've got all the information. So I don't think there's anything for us to hide. And the CVs, like the advocate Swat say, we can release it. We've got nothing to hide.
Patricia, do you
Chairperson, the letter is not only just about CVs. There are other requests too, and some requests about certain questions that we need to ask. So I think we need to look at the letter in holistically, in its full content, and then make a decision based on the other requests too. In terms of the CVs, my view is that once the CV has been submitted to Parliament and the members of Parliament had access to those CVs, we used it to the best of our ability to go to the CVs and try to comply with an Act of Parliament. And that is the process that we have followed. I don't think there was any way that we had excluded anybody on the basis of a criteria that is not in the Act. And I would have thought that maybe we should call the SABC, and let's engage with them on this whole letter that they've sent to us, rather than just to look at whether we put the CVs on the website or not. Thank you.
You see, I think one of the difficulties we have, for example, if you look at the article in the Business Day, it's clearly sponsored by the coalition. Now, they name certain people and raise questions about those people before the person has even had an opportunity to come to Parliament in the public domain and explain whatever needs to be required. I might even venture to say that some of the information there in the article might be factually incorrect. Now, it's not fair that I'm subjected, to an interview. And I come on a Wednesday, but on Tuesday, all the newspapers are saying all sorts of things about me. And I, in a sense, I must come here now and start defending what is in the public domain, when the objective is really for me to come and say why I think I'm the best candidate to serve on the SABC board. And it's for members of Parliament that has the right to interrogate me and to question me and to grill me if they want to, it's fine. But I think this the idea of people being named already in the media before they have an opportunity to make a public appearance is, I think, what is of concern to, as I understand, Mr. Kulwani. Certainly, we cannot object to any information tables in Parliament from that being made available to the public. We can't. In terms of freedom of access to information and those kinds of things, we can't refuse. But I think we also need to be fair to the parties concerned. I mean, Advocate Lewis is here. If there was something said about him in today's newspaper, for example, it puts him at a very distinct disadvantage. He comes here in good faith. He's been nominated by a person or an organization outside. He accepts the nomination, only to see the media saying all sorts of things about him. And he doesn't get an opportunity to respond, which I think is a problem. Ms. Killian?
I hear what you're saying. There's just one other consideration that we should also take, and that is if any of the members of Parliament take up a position in Parliament
you act to enter the political, the public domain. And the same applies for when you accept a nomination. So my concern is just on what basis would there be sensitivities? If issues are raised, should we not welcome that so that the candidates would have the opportunity to respond to some of those questions? Because some of the issues, and I haven't read anything yet, some of those questions could actually direct some of the discussions in this debate. And I do believe that we should encourage public open debate about these matters. I cannot see, you know, nowadays with access to the internet, people will start probing, even if we do not release the CVs as such. So I do believe that it's one of those realities. We're living in a modern age. Access to information is freely available. Secondly, we're looking at the whole principle of the democracy that we've established, and that is openness, frankness, let us debate this. And thirdly, if you go for a public office, you must know you're opening, exposing yourself, and you must be tough to take whatever criticism is leveled at you, and you must be focused. If it means a lot to you to participate and to continue, then you continue. Thank you, Chairman.
I think, Honorable Chairperson, I support what Honorable Kolani said. We are saying, it's not that we don't want to take out the CVs. We are just saying, let that be done after the person has been interviewed, so that that person has a fair chance. And like a person is coming for an interview, yesterday the media was grilling him or her, then it won't be fair. I think it's also our responsibility as this committee to protect the image of the whoever will be interviewed the next day. So I think that we will issue the CVs, but after the person has been interviewed.
Have a good thought. We need your legal assistance now.
So just as a matter of fact, is it correct that as alleged in this media article that the committee said it would release the CVs today? That is, as one would have to establish that as a matter of fact. Then secondly, whether we release it now or during the course of the interviews to me doesn't make any difference. I would prefer that it is released today, because most people would be able to have access in any way on the internet. If you Google these names, they will have all the information in any case. So to me, the principle is of transparency, and I think that is what would recommend or would persuade me to say that from a legal perspective, let's rather show an openness and a transparency from the outset, that we should release the CVs and to indicate that there's nothing to hide. We're not protecting anyone. It's open and in the domain just as much as, and it is regrettable that those comments were made about those individuals, but that is the media's right as well. But I do think that it would help the transparency and accountability process. Similarly, there might be opposition name. Well, it's a joint group, but there might be candidates whose CVs the public needs to have a look at. So I think that it would facilitate, and maybe we can release it today. I don't think there's any huge difference. Thank you, Chair.
No, I think we're not debating. The principle is established. The principle of transparency is established. I think we're looking at fairness to the candidates. You see, what my difficulty is that those names are actually released by the coalition. It's not just a journalist who's picking up somebody's name, picked up the CV somewhere and making comment. It's quoting the coalition. Now, the coalition targets particular individuals but doesn't target its own candidates. That's the difficulty that we're having. If they made a comment about all 31 people, positive or negative, and ask awkward questions, I don't have a problem with that. But to single out one or two people and pose questions about them, I think it's a bit unfortunate, because this is not a closed process. This is a public process. It's open to the media. The TV cameras are running. Anybody is welcome to participate and, I mean, to attend and observe the proceedings. So that's my difficulty, because I think, in a sense, one doesn't know what more questions might follow about some other candidates. And then is that candidate getting a fair opportunity in terms of this process? I don't want someone to come to Parliament almost on a defensive basis. He or she must come here trying to explain something that is out there. That's not fair. the person has agreed to subject himself or herself to a parliamentary process of questioning and going through, not a media process. So we accept the principle of transparency, but I think the request is this, that once, say for example, the Advocate Lewis, once he completes his presentation, we put his CV on the website, he knows about it, we know about it, that's the rules of the game. Because in that way the person has a fair opportunity. Otherwise, I think we might be putting people at a disadvantage here. Can I have Mastori and then Lindiwe?
Thank you, Chairperson, for giving the committee this opportunity to discuss this. But I think as far as I've listened and read this, I think this democracy in South Africa, we are just overdoing everything. Because really, what we are doing here is of a public domain to access whatever we are doing. And as you have said already, this openness, the freedom of speech and everything, that's what we are adhering to. But I don't think, Chairperson, you can allow two processes of interviews. That is what it means, actually. Because they are also, and they are leaving out their candidates, and these speculating on other people, I think it's just unfair, as you have said. I think we are doing a process as Parliament, and they want to do their process as this coalition. I think it's just unfair. That is the reason why I say, I think the democracy in South Africa, I think you are just overdoing everything.
General, you can relax. You can relax.
Mr. Chairperson,
we're not calling for a military coup.
Mr. Chairperson, what it seems to me is that you're suggesting that we must protect the candidates and not the public who've entrusted us to get on with this process. And I take your point about a certain coalition making certain comments about certain candidates, but that isn't a right that's reserved for that coalition. Any member of the public can make comments about any candidate that they want to make comments about. That's the purpose of having a public process. And I think we must be honest now. If we want to close it, then we must say that's what we want to do. If we want to open it, then we must open it fully. But I don't think that we should now argue that we need to protect candidates and not protect the people who have a right to know how this process plays out, because they are understandably, cagey and skeptical coming from the position that the SABC comes from now. And I think we have as much of a duty to protect the South African public and protect their right to information and to openness and transparency as we do to the candidates who are involved in this process. And I really don't think that this committee should now be discussing, engaging in certain measures that would make, things a little bit more, to engage in forward cover on behalf of candidates who understand that this is a public process and who submitted themselves to it and agreed to be nominated for it on that very, condition. So I would agree with my colleague on this side who say that we must release the CVs today.
Mr. Kolwane and Geneva? Yeah, Geneva, you give Geneva a
chance. Chairperson and honorable member, I think if this committee had shortlisted the names and published them, that on this particular day they will be subjected to interviews. I don't think there is any offense if we release those CVs for public to scrutinize them. I mean, Business Day, I didn't read that article, wrote that article using their sources, call them coalition. So they are free to express themselves, but let's stay focused. We shortlisted the candidates. The public wants to know who is Mrs. So-and-so, who is Mr. So-and-so. It would be fair to inform the public. After all, a CV is not a secret, man. This is a public exercise. Thank you.
Mr. Kulwani? Okay, Patricia?
Chairperson, I think maybe we should come closer to where the point of difference is at the moment. I think we all agree that the CVs be made public. What you are suggesting is that, yes, we will make the CVs public, but only after we have interviewed the candidate. That seems to be the only point of difference that we maybe need to agree on.
Mr. Mr. Kulwani?
I agree. No one is questioning the issue of rights of the public and so on. By the way, the candidates are also public. So you cannot talk about public in isolation of the candidates and persons if they are not public because they chose to be candidates. Now, Chair, all that we are saying exactly what Honorable Dile is saying, that the person will come here immediately, passes here, technology so quick, then the CV is posted. It goes. By the time we finish the last one, all the CVs are out there. I think that's what we're just proposing, what to do and so on. I understand all the issues which are raised. No one disagrees those issues, and we can't contest those issues which have been raised around that particular matter. So, Chair, that's just our submission, Chair, that if we can do that and so on. Because really, Chair, as we have put it, it becomes unfair sometimes to the candidates to be scrutinized before they come even to the committee and so on. And I think, Chair, the other thing, we'll have to engage with our SAPC. Because you see, Chair, if you read the letter, this is a court determination which they are asking equal partners in terms of dealing with the process, Chair. I'm saying what Honorable Dilip said is that she proposed that there will be a need to engage several SAPC so that we understand exactly, Chair, from what position they are moving from and so on. For argument's sake, Chair, if you read the letter, it's saying before you finalize the name is presented to the National Assembly, they need to be given a chance to come and make presentation on the cabinet. That's what they're asking. Now, Chair, you see, once you've got that matter, that they must come and make a presentation on the 12th, which must be submitted to Parliament. I think Chair must also accept that if other organizations, they see that there is a weakness in the legislation, there are processes which are currently going on in terms of overhauling the legislation of the SAPC, of the public broadcasting and so on. I think it would be fair that some of the things must also be factored to that amendment so that as we move forward this process, we also understand not just to put things in between, whereas the current legislation is there in terms of how things must be handled and so on. But I get the point that they'll need to be engaged at one point or another in terms of understanding exactly what might be the issues with that.
I want to close this matter. Can we agree that after the interviews, we'll post the CV? You are insisting, Ms. Killian, that we must be posted beforehand. And why didn't you insist last week? Because these names were made public last week. We should have put the CVs on the parliamentary website last week then.
Chairperson, I must be honest. I thought it was a matter of course that it would be published because it has been a very transparent process up to now. So I didn't think that that would have been a contentious issue. The concern that I've raised is exactly what I've said. You can Google anybody in any case. We will not stop the debate in the media, and I think it's good that people take ownership of this process. All I'm just suggesting is if it is a serious problem, we're prepared to quickly split, to break up, if you would like to discuss it with your colleagues, because it is a matter of timing, and we believe it's important to give people credibility in our process. We don't want to jeopardize the process. The outcomes, I do believe it's going far beyond what the coalition could expect from us to enter with them into a debate about this election. Because if we do that with them, we should do that with everybody else. So clearly, we have to draw the line. We have a constitutional responsibility. We have a legislative responsibility. We will carry our duty in as much as that is concerned. But I do believe as far as the transparency and credibility of the process is concerned, it would be important to release it straight away. Thank you, Chair.
And see, do we have to split hairs on this matter?
Chair, maybe, can I make another proposal, Chair? Maybe that one will assist us to move forward. Let us release CV for those people who are appearing today. And tomorrow we'll release another batch of CVs for those who will appear before the committee tomorrow and things like that. I think by that we'll
will protect their image while at the same time we are giving public the information that they deserve to get.
Advocate Scott, can you help us?
Yeah, we appreciate the gesture, but then I don't see the... We really are splitting hairs now. We're spending a lot of time. Whether it's released today or tomorrow will make no difference in my view, because those names can be Googled. And I think that it would be really in the sense of transparency to just enforce that principle if we release, because now the suggestion, and I appreciate the suggestion as trying to find a way forward, but we are splitting hairs, and I think we should just release them all today. End of story. And I'd ask you maybe, Chair, to make a ruling in the matter. Thank you.
We don't have to crack our heads on this matter, Chair. But, Chair, we also, Chair, weren't going to agree, Chair, to release all of them to this. That's the way to go.
No, it's not. I don't think this is a matter we need to vote on. No, can I appeal? Look, I've heard the arguments from both sides. Can I appeal to the ANC? I think let's release the names. Right, we are starting now with the interviews. If those were scheduled for tomorrow or the day after, if there's anything good said about them or negative said about them, we'll give them an opportunity to clear up the matters here. But can we agree on that one? I don't want to rule. I think it would be better if we are in agreement on this matter. Can we release the series today?
Chairperson will agree if opportunity before we interview them will be given to clear their names on what will be appearing on the meeting.
That's fine.
Thanks.
We agree that we could pose any question to people, and if they want to clear up anything that's in the public domain, we'll afford them this opportunity. All right, fine. So sometime today we'll put the series on. Sir. It's an administrative matter.
That will include the one the business day today. That those who appear today,
yes.
When they come, they must clear their names in terms of what appears.
Yeah. That'd be fine. All right, we can pass over this matter. Is there any other matter that we need to in terms of housekeeping? Mr. Lewis is waiting outside. Mr. Kolwane?
I think, Chair, we went through a very difficult process, Chair, in terms of trying to shortlist. Oh, no, it's fine, Chair. You need some coca sometime. No, Chair, I'm saying last week we went through a very engaging and involving process in trying to get the shortlisted names, Chair, which we're supposed to be interviewing today. But through that process, Chair, when we finalized that process, and the name which we have agreed that should be the names which we are going to interview, there was an omission. There was an omission of one candidate. I don't know, Chair, because I can't explain how did it escape the administration in terms of capturing that particular matter. Because one name of Felang Sekha Lorraine, which was agreed that will be part of that final list, Chair, was omitted on that final list. Obviously, Chair, it was Thursday, then we could not raise that matter Friday, because Friday and it was Wednesday, and then we had the Hutla and the other things which were going on during those two names. So it was very difficult to raise that matter or to try to request an urgent meeting for the committee to convene and deal with that matter. We felt that it's a matter which we are going to raise to this meeting today. I can't explain, Chair, how it happened. It's just that the name was omitted on the list. It has the effect of the matter, Chair, which was supposed to be part of the final list. Thanks.
Chair, if it was a bona fide mistake, then I do suggest that we include that name, particularly in view of other withdrawals that have taken place since then. And I think that that would only be fair to that candidate.
Julie?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. And then whilst we are dealing with that issue, can we also perhaps just establish that we have received a formal withdrawal from Professor Fonsel Flaubert as well as Mr. Michael Louis.
Those are the other housekeeping matters that are pointing out. Yeah.
And we would like to suggest some sort of people, which Patricia would be doing. Thank you.
Patricia?
Chairperson, I was going to suggest that the task team meet, find some time to meet, because the ATC has been published with a 31 name, and the task team meet and then come back to the committee with a full report and suggestions of replacements.
All right, good. Mr. Van der Berg, you
want to say something? I just want to urge this committee that we will time-wise skip, but stick to our schedule, otherwise it will be a grueling session. I appeal to this committee.
I understand what you're saying, but there are certain housekeeping things we have
to do. Yeah, I know that.
Look, I think I'm the name of Feleng Seka was confirmed by the task team. It is genuinely an administrative error that the name fell off. So if the proposal is that we confirm her, then the administration can make the arrangement to contact her. Can the committee take that decision? And then there's a second proposal, is the task team meets sometime this evening or so, just to look at other housekeeping arrangements that might come up. Okay, that's fine. Then I've got a table two formal withdrawals. Let me just get them. We've got a withdrawal from Mr. Michael Louis. It's on a letterhead that's signed, and basically he's saying that his company board is not giving him permission to serve on the SAPC board. And as a result, with great regret, he is withdrawing. We confirm that this is the case. Can we approve of this withdrawal and then recognize that we've got one candidate less? And then also that we received a correspondence from the personal secretary of Dr. Van der Slabbert, indicating that he will not be able to accept his nomination as he's going into retirement and will be spending most of his time in Swaziland. That's what the formal note says. So we've confirmed this with the secretary, his personal secretary, that this is the position. So we've got a note, the withdrawal of Fundrail Slavic also. All right. There were two other matters. let me just find that letter. One is a letter from Reverend Pastor Reverend Makoto. It's a handwritten letter. I had received correspondence from him last week saying that he wanted to be shortlisted and wanted to be nominated for the board. I replied to him saying that the process is closed, the nominations are closed, the committee had already shortlisted people and the interviews are scheduled for today. He's got another letter that has come out saying that I'm not understanding his letter. He doesn't want to be shortlisted, he wants to be co-opted. After the board is constituted, he wants to be co-opted. And this is a matter he's prepared to die for. So, can you give me permission to write a courteous letter to him telling him that the process is closed? Thank you very much. Then there's one more. Otherwise, I can refer the matter to the General Bantolo to deal with. General, can I leave that matter after? If there's any further correspondence, I'm leaving it in your hands. Then we've got a letter from the Professional Women's Forum. Again here, somehow the media had published the name of Ms. Tebogo Mokgatlo as a person who has been shortlisted. I saw the article I think it was the Sowetan. They in fact sent me the article. And indeed her name does appear as a shortlisted candidate. We contacted this particular grouping to indicate that, look, the official list that we can release to the person is that it was Mr. Anthony Mokgatlo Mello, and not Tebogo Mokgatlo. I thought I just needed to put this on record that maybe the media got it wrong again. I don't know where they got that name from, but The official list on the AGC is Anthony Makhaza Mello is the person that has been shortlisted, and we have communicated that already to this particular grouping. All right, we are now over with all our housekeeping matters. Can we call in Mr. David Harris Lewis, please? I think he got bored by all this admin work that we were busy with. Advocate Lewis. It's not Advocate Lewis, it's David Lewis. David Harris Lewis. Please accept our apology for keeping you waiting. I know you were on the early morning flight and you were here promptly at 5 to 10, so these are some admin matters that we had to go through. Warm welcome to you, Mr. Lewis. The procedure is very simple. We're going to give you 3 to 5 minutes to talk to your CV and maybe tell us why you think you'll be a worthy candidate to serve on the SCBC board. And then really it's a free for all. Members of parliament throw curveballs, they throw straight balls, they'll ask questions, and then it's up to you to defend yourself and to answer the question. So over to you.
Good, thank you, Mr. Chairperson. You will have seen from my CV that I'm trained as an economist. I did my undergraduate training at WITS and my postgraduate training at UCT, and immediately upon completing my postgraduate training I spent the 70s and the 80s working in the trade union movement. I then returned to UCT, where I led a large project on industrial policy for that was sponsored by the union movement, and have worked since then in various areas of policy advice. I was advisor to the Minister of Labour, who was then Tito Mboweni. I chaired the Presidential Commission on Labour Markets that Minister Mboweni set up. I then worked together with Minister Irwin in the Department of Trade and Industry on drafting a new competition policy. And when that resulted in the passing of the Competition Act, I was appointed to chair the Competition Tribunal, and my second and last term ended a couple of weeks ago. In that period, I've also served 4 terms on the board of the Industrial Development Corporation. I currently am on the board of the Johannesburg Development Agency. So you'll see that all of my working life has been in public service or NGOs like the trade union movement. It is, though, a world in which I've come into very close contact with the corporate world. Through the IDC, through my work in the union movement, through my work on industrial policy. So I've come to understand questions of corporate governance quite closely. I've seen some good practices, I've seen some very bad practices. While I would not profess to be an expert on broadcasting, broadcasting is a very big issue in competition law and competition economics. And so I've come to understand it from that perspective. We've done a large case on the radio industry in South Africa. I understand something about that. And also in my work in the IDC, I've come to appreciate, hence I think my nomination in part, I've come to appreciate the importance and the potential of the film industry in South Africa and the extent to which it's a really good industry and one that would hold us in the country in good stead, including from an employment creation point of view, has been really undermined by a very poor demand side. And so those, I think, are, I say in all modesty, the attributes that I would bring to the board. As I say, is an understanding of governance issues and experience in governance issues, and particularly through the IDC, though a very different institution to the SABC, one that is used to the very difficult process of balancing commercial and public interest issues. Although they sell, if you like, or provide very different products and services, each of them has this very difficult balance to maintain, which is very particular to certain kinds of state-owned enterprises. So I bring that board experience, and I bring a certain degree of knowledge of the broadcasting industry, and I would like to think that I bring a history of public service. And I would see this as a continuation of that public service.
Thank you very much. The hands are shooting up. Thank you, Pandavia.
Thank you, Chairperson, Mr. Lewis. If you look back at over the past 2-3 years, what do you think was the biggest mistakes the SABC made? And do you think that the new board will be in a position to sort of fix the SABC again? And what will you do to get them on a smoother base of road or whatever?
Thank you for that, Mr. Vandenberg. You know, one of the things that I have to say does slightly concern me about joining the board is I think the expectation that the SABC will be fixed very quickly. And I think that it will take some time to fix what seems from the outside, and I know what I read in the media, I know what I hear from people in the film industry, is a severely damaged institution, but one that is very important and that has to be fixed. But I think that expectations are that it would be fixed more quickly than it can. I think the SABC have made a number of mistakes. The one that stands out most starkly to me is their inability to keep control of their cost structure. I think that overwhelmingly is the crisis that the SABC faces at the moment. And then, with respect, a board that I don't think sufficiently understood the boundaries between being a non-executive and being an executive, a board that never understood that its raison d'etre, its purpose was to guard the strategic considerations and to represent a fiduciary interest, but not to interfere with management. What would I do on my own, I suppose, very little, but I would like to think that with a good board and with a good chairman we will appoint, which is unquestionably the most urgent task facing the SABC, appoint a good CEO and a good executive suite, if you like, and then start to work on cost containment, which is going to be very difficult, because I think it's, as cost containment always is, that you have to contain costs without cutting into the muscle either of the SABC or of the very important industries like the film industry that serve the SABC. So I think those are the most important things. Probably the most immediate thing is going to be a meeting with the Minister of Finance to work out how to bail out the SABC, because I think truly that probably is going to be a necessary part of the process. I hope that's answered your question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lewis. You have an impressive CV when it comes to corporate governance. However, can I just ask you, how would you manage conflict? And we saw the history of conflict with the board and the executive of SABC that reached an untenable level from a management perspective. And then secondly, how would you ensure that government, political parties, and other major vested interests do not interfere with news and programming at the SABC? And then lastly, do you have any conflict of interest with a perceived or real? And if so, how would you deal with any conflict of interest from a personal perspective? Thank you.
Maybe let me deal with the, if I could, Mr. Swart, the last question first. I don't have any conflict of interest at all. I don't have any shares in the film industry. I don't act in any capacity that impacts upon the SABC in a direct sense, and certainly not in a commercial sense. I think conflicts of interest can be managed. I think sometimes conflicts of interest are so great that they can only be managed by separating the two interests completely. But I think that they can be managed, they can be declared. It depends on the scale of the conflict. But I have no conflict of interest. How to manage conflicts between the board and the executive? For one thing, and I know that this is a difficult question, I think that the board should appoint the executive. I certainly think that the board should appoint the chief executive, so that the chief executive knows that his or her responsibility and accountability is to the board. And the board, again, as I answered in response to Mr. van den Berg's question, the board needs to understand and appreciate the boundaries between being a non-executive board on the one hand and executives, and leave the business of running the corporation to the executives, with the board overseeing the broad strategy and the broad mandate and ensuring that those are complied with. They should not, in other words, tread on each other's toes, and most particularly the board should not involve itself in micromanagement of the conflict. In micromanagement of the institution. The news board, the whole question of current affairs and news programming and conflicts that may arise there, I think is a built-in tension in all media. I think in order to manage it, you need a board of integrity. You need a board of sufficient standing that it will be respected by powerful political and social interests that may want to influence it. And you need a board that respects the legitimacy of powerful and not so powerful interests in wanting their voice to be heard through the media. So firstly, the way to manage that depends upon the character of the board. I think that there are also some institutional issues that would bear looking at. And just to throw out one or two ideas, I am interested in the notion of what I see the SAVE, our SAVC coalition, is called a public editor, who I understand to be what I would call probably an ombudsman. An employee of the SABC who would be a direct report to the chairman or the chairperson of the board, and who would be responsible for understanding the responses of stakeholders to the SABC. That's quite a controversial suggestion, particularly from somebody who has just stressed the importance of separation between the board and the management. But this would be a very different kind of person. I also would like to be involved in the debate about whether there should be a separation, as has been suggested, between the CEO on the one hand and the editor-in-chief on the other hand. This is traditionally the way certainly the print media is run, and may be a good way of ensuring that those two issues. There is also the question of commercial pressure. And that's another whole story altogether. I don't think, for example, that news and current affairs programming should be financed out of advertising. I think a lot of other things can be financed effectively out of advertising. But I think that news and current affairs programs should not lay themselves open to commercial influence any way, any more than they should lay themselves open to narrow political interests.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Just to follow up a little bit on the issue of conflict of interest, you've indicated what your own position is, but we have had in the recent past, we have had some allegations which are currently being investigated by the Auditor General of conflict of interest by some of the top executive management. How do you think should that be approached? Do you believe that you should simply declare your conflict and then continue with your business
with the SABC if you're an employee? Or do you believe that you should refrain from doing that? That's the first question. The second question is just, it is interesting that you have mentioned the fact that the non-executive members should not try to micromanage. How would you, however, ensure compliance by the executive of the PFMA to account for commercial television on the one side and the public service on the other side, etc., if you introduce some measures to curtail expenditure in view of economic downturn or whatever, and it is not heeded? How would a board member act in such a case? Could you perhaps just give us a
There's a lot of complicated questions. The conflict of interest issue regarding executives, I don't think is a difficult question. I think that there should not be a conflict of interest, period. I don't think that it's acceptable for an executive of any corporation to be involved in being a supplier to the corporation at the same time. I don't think that such an interest can be declared and then accepted. There are potential ways, I suppose, again, of managing small conflicts through declarations. But in general, I think that people who are paid a salary as executives of a corporation should work for the corporation, and they should not be, frankly, doing anything else. But they certainly should not be doing anything that benefits from their or may be seen to be a benefit from their position in the institution. Your second question is a long and complicated question. There are accountability structures through the PFMA that all public institutions have to abide by, and if they don't, they will not get a clean audit. And in circumstances like that, the board must hold the management accountable for the responsibility to ensure that it has a clean audit, both in terms of the PFMA and in terms of general accounting practice. And so that should not necessitate or encourage the board to get involved in the process of management as well. The board is involved in the process of accountability, and the executive are accountable to the board for doing what they're required to do in terms of the PFMA and doing what they are required to do in terms of general accounting practice. The public service and commercial issue is a little bit more difficult. I was frankly taken by surprise at the extent to which the SABC relies on advertising revenue. I knew it relied on it to a large extent, but you know, after this nomination and I started to try and learn a little bit more about the details of it, I'm surprised at the extent to which it's reliant on advertising revenue. I think that there are ways of ring fencing the manner in which advertising revenue is used on the one hand, and money from the fiscus or through licenses are used on the other hand. As I said earlier, I think that current affairs programming and news should preferably not be up for being influenced by advertising revenue. In other circumstances, I think that advertising revenue can promote positive programming. There is some programming that advertisers will not support because it does not get the right kind of viewership or listenership. Children's programming, for example, educational programming very often doesn't attract commercial sponsorship. And those are the kinds of activities that I think should be funded out of the public money that the SABC is entrusted with. But for the rest, I think it can be funded out of advertising revenue. But its public interest mandate should be supported in general by public funds. there are some interesting instances. In the United States is one where National Public Radio, for example, which is an excellent service, is funded entirely out of donations from the corporate social responsibility activities of large corporates. But it's not advertising money. It's more in the nature of sponsorship. But even that, I would be quite wary of in regard to the public interest mandate of the SABC, which includes its news and current affairs programs. It's a public broadcaster, and I think it should continue to be one rather than principally a commercial activity.
No, Chair. Monique, advocate.
I'm not an advocate.
Oh, you're not an advocate?
Yes. An economist. Economist would never want to be called an advocate.
Comrade. Economist.
Economist. I thought you were saying comrade.
No. Thanks very much. My question, Chair. The first one will be just a short and direct one. Are you having a TV set in your house? And if you do, do you pay the TV license? That is a simple and short one. Straightforward. That's the first question.
Yes, to both.
The second one, because I don't see a need to interview a person for SABC board who does not dare to pay the TV license. In the first instance. the second question, Chen, is around this issue of part of what we've observed ourselves as a committee in the SABC and the SABC board and the management, in particular in the SABC, is the question whether how do you see, you have indicated that you've got the experience and the skill which can bring changes to the SABC. But how do you use the strength which you are having yourself as an individual to the team? Because I think there's a clear distinction where one individual has the skill and the strength and everything but cannot work within a team. And I don't see a board operating in isolation if they are not a team. How do you link that to your experience and your strengths in terms of working in terms of a team? The second question is in relation to, you know, the current legislation, your view around that. It allows that board members who've got the conflict of interest with the SABC, if the board is going to meet, they can excuse themselves. If a decision is going to be made, it's going to have that member of the board is going to have interest in that decision in terms of his business associate and so on. Following the question of the executive, in your view, do you think that board members will have an interest in the business of SABC as the board members of the SABC? Notwithstanding the legislation, I see the legislation as it stands, but what is your view or what do you want to see moving forward around that particular matter in terms of the legislation? The third question, Chair, is in relation to the matter of, you see, Parliament is one institution where public interests are being taken care of, but currently we don't have a dedicated channel for Parliament. The one we have is with subscription, which surveys clearly indicate that the majority of our people cannot afford. What is your view for SABC to have a dedicated channel and a radio station for Parliament, so that people, they do have access and they can follow debates in Parliament as they are unfolding and so on? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kulwani. If I understood your first question correctly, I just from the nature of the work that I've done has always been teamwork. I work best in institutions. and that's what I enjoy doing, and that's how I've always worked. I mean, one of the strange aspects of being on the short list for an institution like this is that you don't know who the other members of the team are going to be, and quite clearly you work better with some teams than you work with other teams, but you have to simply constitute yourself as a team after this and hope that you work well with them, and particularly with whoever is the chair of the board. But I've worked with without naming names, I've worked with some very difficult people before, and we've generally managed to sort ourselves out. Well, I was thinking of somebody else in Pretoria, actually.
I guess you can name, but you won't shame.
I would prefer it immensely if board members did not have conflicts with their role as SABC at all. But I know, for example, and many of you may disagree with me, in the IDC board, for example, where forever it has been the case that there sit on the board business people who also have commercial relations with the IDC. And this is not only by any means a phenomenon since 1994. It has always been a phenomenon because you want experienced business people to head up an institution like that, and the fear is that you would not be able to attract them if they were at the same time denied the possibility of any business relationship with the IDC. What we did there, interestingly enough, is that we constituted a special committee of the board that was called the Directors' Interest Committee. That was the committee composed of those directors who had no interest in working with the IDC in any capacity other than as a board member. And any decision involving their interest had to be made by that committee. And that committee's mandate was to ensure that whatever proposal came to it that implicated the interest of a director was treated in exactly the same way as would a proposal that did not involve a director. So that's an example of how to manage conflict. Frankly, in an institution like the SABC, I don't see why there should be any conflict. This is not a financial institution that businesses have a lot to do with. And so I don't think that there should be people whose interests are conflicted on the board of the SABC. Parliament and public interest, I'm not sure. I think it would be. I think it's an interesting idea. Again, I know it's done in the US on pay television. It's done here to some extent on pay television, but I think it is an interesting idea, and certainly for important debates, I think there's sometimes quite a great distance between what people think happens in Parliament and what does happen in Parliament, and I think that it should be publicised. I should have also, you know, while on this question, answered to Ms. Killian that another reporting responsibility and accountability responsibility that the SABC has is to ICASA as well. That's an organisation too, I say with respect, needs some severe attention. But it nevertheless the SABC is statutorily obligated to account to ICASA largely for its mandate and the extent to which its programming conforms with it. So there are a lot of accountability structures that an institution like the SABC has through the PFMA, through ICASA, and then through the board, and then through this committee.
Yeah, Chairperson, my question is one, the first one, since you've got a competition background, do you think part of the performance of the SABC is due to lack of competition? And that the competition is really with the pay stations, which most of our people don't have access to. What will you do in terms of making the SABC more competitive
competitive, not only looking at the South African scenario, but made competitive in terms of peer countries, you know, Brazil, Chile, India, places like that. My second question is, there is certainly a lack of local content on SABC. What will you propose if you become a board member for SABC? And the last one is, you made some suggestions about a funding model for the SABC. Have you got any concrete ideas there? Do you think that government should put in more money into SABC? The reliance, like you say, on commercial efforts and so, you did say it's always not, it's not good. What will you propose as a funding model for the SABC? Thank you.
It's difficult to talk. Thank you, Mr. Law. It's difficult to talk about the SABC and the television market and the radio market as one would talk about the market for soap powder. It's very heavily regulated, as it should be, and there is a large measure of public money that goes into one of the institutions active in that market, to wit, the SABC. But I think that's one of the advantages of having at least a large chunk of the SABC funded by advertising, that there's nothing that ensures that you attract audience to certain of your shows than having to prove yourself to advertisers. Now, there's always a risk that you really dumb down your programming in order to attract large audiences. I don't have such a cynical view of, frankly, people who watch television. I think people would watch good television if it were offered to them, and there seems to be no reason why advertisers should not be attracted to that. But the SABC does, to some extent, work in a competitive market. It works in a competitive market against ETV, for one, and then against the pay television networks, which I agree with you, the vast majority of people in the country don't have access to, but that is nevertheless still a competitor. And I think that there are ways of benchmarking the SABC. For example, again, in England, the BBC assesses its ratings numerically, but it also has a way of assessing what they call an appreciation index, of getting a greater idea of what people think of the quality of its programming, and why they think what they think of the quality of their programming. So there is a way of doing both. I'll come to the local content issue in a second. On the funding model, you know, there's been much debate about this. I think that I don't think that you should divide the stations, the various channels of the SABC, up between those that serve the public interest and those that compete in the market. I think it's rather in the programming, and each channel should be able to attract a certain proportion of its revenue through advertising. And, you know, I was thinking, I had imagined that the SABC had something between 30 and 50% of its revenue was advertising and that the rest was from the license fees. Instead, the figure that I've seen is that about 70% is from advertising and about 30% from the license fees. So I would want to see that balance slightly corrected, I think, in that direction. So the funding model would be a hybrid model of advertising and then public funds. As to where the public funds come from, it seems to me, and I would, you know, like to hear people more expert in this than I am telling me this, but it seems to me that it costs an enormous amount of money to collect the licensing fees, as Mr. Gowani sort of intimated. And I'm not really sure that it's worth spending that much money on collecting license fees. Licensing is also a regressive tax, because poor people pay the same amount of their license fee as rich people pay, which I think is, again, contrary to much of our sort of taxation-type policy. So So I think, and that's why I mentioned the Minister of Finance when I first spoke, that I think that this should come from a general, from a parliamentary vote. There is a way of taxing in such a way that there is a degree of certainty attached to the revenue that the SABC will receive. In other words, there should be a way of immunizing it from narrow political considerations. You can have a dedicated tax on I can't say I've thought about this deeply enough, but I think you don't want to be subject, you don't want the SABC to come and have to crawl up the steps of Parliament every year for its grant. There should be a way of dedicating a certain share of the fiscus, if you like, to the public broadcaster, so it remains relatively independent of narrow interests. Local content, I think, is very important, and I think it's very important for two reasons. I think it's important because we're in the kind of industries here and the kind of activities here that to some extent represent the cultural life of the country, and so I think local content is important for that reason. It's also important, and this is a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, that the film, we have a very capable film industry in this country. We have very capable technicians, we have very capable facilities, we have very capable studios, we have very capable people in the film industry. It is an immensely labor-intensive industry. I think people really underestimate the film industry from that point of view. It's unusual in that it's both technology-intensive, and so the more you do, the more technological knowledge you spread, but it's also immensely labor-intensive. And it has gotten a fair amount of support from the IDC, it's gotten a fair amount of support from the DTI, it's gotten, in other words, a fair amount of supply-side support. But what it needs is the support of the largest commissioner of local programming in the country, and that is the SABC. It needs much more consistent support from that. And if so, I think that we could be on the cusp of turning ourselves into another great third world film industry, as they have in the strangest of places. Not always producing the highest quality films, but in places like Nigeria, Iran, Egypt, India, great local film industries, because there is demand for the product, and the SABC, an institution like the SABC, has to be at the forefront of creating that demand. So I think there should be local content requirements, and I think that our industry will respond well to the demand being placed upon it, because I think it's a capable industry.
Members, just be mindful of time. I know you've got this pent-up feeling. You want to ask all these questions, but many more are coming. but you've still got a whole lot of people lined up.
Now you've forgotten about me, but number 30, I'm sure.
There's Susanna, then Lindiwe, and then General. Can we make it the last, please?
But Jefferson, can I suggest that you try and be brief when you respond to questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Jefferson. Mr. Lewis, I just have two questions, very simple. That in your view, what management style do you think should be adopted to get the operational synergy right between the SABC board and its management? In your own view, that currently the public has their own view about the current SABC. What do you think the management style should be introduced to change that negative thinking about the SABC board? Something new that will turn the SABC a new leaf. Secondly, is the issue of the languages. In South Africa, we have 11 languages official. Do you think, in your view, that all these 11 languages are covered correctly in all channels? They are promoted? Or if not so, what do you think must be done to make sure that all 11 languages receive equal treatment or promotion in all channels that we have? And I've been listening to you, Mr. Lewis, since you started, really. I just have this interest. I've noted some strong elements of your strength, but I didn't touch a little bit of your weakness. If you can just one or two little things that we have.
Take all the questions.
Yes, I will.
Quickly.
Thank you. You've actually answered quite a few of my questions. I wanted to ask, you mentioned before the importance of the relationship between the executive and the non-executive members. You do know that the interim board is appointing the executive committee. So you're appointed to the board, you assume office. How do you think you will handle the fact that there's already an existing quite new executive structure, which you must now take over oversight over? You've dealt with the funding model. How do you imagine the SABC will deal with the digital migration in the midst of its current, financial woes? How would you tackle that? The question of deadlines and the timetable and so on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sir, you might have observed that the problems of the SABC in the past have not been caused mainly by the failure of the board members, but by the executives and management in general. How will you deal with a situation where some of the board of some of the SABC executive directors undermine the board authority? You can call them the untouchables, if you like. They would run like spoiled children to their masters in the union building. Begin to badmouth the very board, especially if they feel that you are treading into their territory. So we would like to ask you, will you quit or just keep quiet? Because I think we have been wasting our time in this house by appointing and changing boards after boards, but we are not attacking the real problem, which is the executive and the management. Will you be in a position, for instance, to recommend that the new board must conduct a serious skills auditing to check whether the management and the executive board are competent enough to mend those positions? Thank you.
I'm not sure what to say about management style. I think that there is something very particular about an institution like the SABC, and I think you've got to have a chief executive and an executive team that considers itself accountable to the public. And I'm not exactly sure what style that takes, but you need a chief executive officer who is comfortable at relating to the public, not one who is necessarily only a bean counter or an engineer, but somebody who can genuinely engage with the public. And that's really all that I can say about management style, except that it's not rocket science. There are a lot of large corporations out there that have managed themselves a lot better than the SABC has. My understanding is that official languages, broadcasting in the 11 official languages, is part of the public service mandate of the SABC. I don't know whether it does it sufficiently or not, but it certainly should be part of the public service mandate of the SABC, and it's what should be, it's one of those things that should be paid for out of public funds. I'm not in a position to evaluate whether it's done sufficiently or not. What are my weaknesses? A fair amount of impatience and a tendency to talk too much, as Mr. Holomisa has observed. But I think impatience is a weakness that I try and contain. But it's also sometimes necessary. I've heard that the interim board is appointing the exco. It may be unavoidable, but I think it's extremely unfortunate. I mean, I don't know what the plans are about when this board will be in place. I believe that it takes office at the beginning of next year. If the members are known before then, or certainly if the chair is known before then, it may be a very good idea to give this board some role in the appointment of the executive team. I think it is extremely unfortunate, and I can't stress that strongly enough, that the board will not be appointing the chief executive officer and other members of the executive, which in some sense goes to answer Mr. Holomisa's question, is that I don't think that the executive should be untouchable. And I don't think that their masters should be in the union buildings, if indeed they are in the union buildings. That's why I think that the executive should be appointed by the board, and they should be accountable to the board. You know, we should also be realistic about this, is that you don't, you know, the board would not appoint necessarily an executive, the chief executive, who had a prior bad relationship with the president or with the, or even with the Minister of Communications. I think there's, you know, there's a certain sense one has to exercise in making that appointment. But I think that they should be accountable to the executive, to the board, and that's the end of it. And if they violate the board's authority, then they're fired. The digital migration issue, which is the last question that I was asked, I think it's going to have an interesting impact on the SABC. I don't know about the deadlines and how they are being met or if they are being met. I know what I read in the media. But I think the digital migration gives the SABC the potential for more stations. I think it's not a bad idea for the SABC to have more channels, in the sense that it is able to spread some of its underemployed assets over a larger number of channels, and it has more space for meeting its public service mandate. But that doesn't mean that I think it should take up every additional channel that is available to it. We all know that the SABC is having enough trouble managing the channels that it does have. If it wants to take an entire multiplex in the digital migration process and take, for example, 7 new channels, my instinct, without knowing the details of it, is that that would be too much for the SABC to handle. And so the SABC's share of channels is going to be somewhat diluted as a result of the digital migration process. But that's not altogether a bad thing. It will get something more, but it's the proportion of channels, I think, that are owned by the SABC will shrink as new players come in and take up the additional channels on offer.
Cyril, thank you very much. You know, you've had to face this first barrage of questions, but I think as the people come in, you might get tired in asking a few more questions. Thank you very much for your time and for your patience.
Thank you very much for nominating, for putting me on this short list.
That was a pleasure.
Great honor.
Are you flying back now?
I am.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Keep going. Can we get the next person, Mr. Mullah? There are no candidates sitting here, am I right? Because in the mix, some people could have walked in now. All right. Welcome to the committee meeting. Sorry that we have kept you waiting for quite some time.
Not a problem.
But I think we will catch up with time as we move on. We're going to, the interview will last about 40 minutes or so. We're going to ask you to send your CV for between 3 to 5 minutes. Tell us why you think you are worthy candidates for the SABC board. And then members will ask questions. I can't predict what questions they're going to ask. Some of them are very easy. Some of them are tough. But we'll leave it to them. So over to you.
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. Members of the committee, thanks for giving me this opportunity to actually address you. I feel privileged for you to have actually shortlisted me. I'm actually going to talk more on my time at the SABC. Actually, I was one of the first non-white managers at the SABC, appointed in 93. I myself was the first Indian manager to be appointed at the SABC. I started off as a very small channel. In fact, it was the smallest channel in the world, NNTV. It was called CSS first. NNTV, I worked my way up. We relaunched SCSS to NNTV. I then became general manager finance for the SABC television division. In 96, I relaunched SABC TV into SABC 1, 2, and 3. In fact, that was my main task that year, was to actually do the launch of the TV channels. After we actually relaunched television, we went through a major crisis as well as what actually the SABC went through now. We actually lost a lot of money when we relaunched. We actually lost about 100 million rand in the first 3 months, but we actually had a quick turnaround strategy. And with good management and with a very good board with Dr. Ivy Matsepe Kasaburi at that stage, and Zulaki as our CEO, we actually changed our schedule quite quickly, and we actually got the money back. I left the SABC in end of 96 because I had been through a tremendous trying time that year because I had really put a lot of energy into the SABC. I went out for 2 years and I came back. They actually asked me to come back to relaunch the SABC radio division. And that was in 99. I was in charge of 18 radio stations and was the finances of the radio stations. That budget was about 300 million. The television budget previously was about over a billion rand. I actually had a lot of success at the television, at the radio stations. And in that time as well, I actually had to run all the finances of the SABC. I had to run radio, television, and operations because we had lost a lot of key managers. And because of my experience in television, I had to then step to the plate. I've got intimate knowledge of the SABC finances. I've actually got a lot of thoughts on what actually went wrong at the SABC. I've actually got my own ideas, especially with Content Hub. I left SABC to go to become the first CFO of the first permanent CFO of ICASA with Mandla Langa. I actually set up all the finances there at ICASA, so you know it was a progressive move for me. So overall, I feel I have a very strong broadcast experience, on the job experience. I've actually been in charge of finances. I know exactly what the problems are. I've got the regulatory experience as well. I've got overall management experience. I serve on a lot of audit committees for government. Actually, I chaired the audit committee for the provincial audit committee in Gauteng. I chaired three of their subcommittees as well for education, finance, education, community safety, and sports. And I actually served on other audit committees as well in City Parks, City Power. I'm a board member of Gauteng Tourism. And I chair the audit committee of Gauteng Tourism. So overall, I think my CV speaks to an overall background in broadcasting.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sterling, Advocate Swart.
Chairperson, just going through your CV.
Sorry, Chair. Of course, sorry.
My surname is Swart. Yeah, Mr. Muller, I've just gone through your CV as you are presenting yourself. And I just want to ask a question. Seeing that you have done so well in SABC, especially in finances, from 99, establishing all the departments you have been working in. And you decided to go to ICASA. Was there a specific reason for you to do that? Seeing now that you want to think you should go back to SABC, maybe you can explain to me. And the second question I would like to ask you, what would be your thinking about the acting board, the decision that they've taken on closing down the other bureaus internationally? Do you think that has got something to do with the financial status they're in? Can you just give us a few of your opinions about it?
Thanks, Jim. I'll answer. Your first question relates to me moving to ICASA. I actually felt that as a progressive move for myself, just before I moved to ICASA, I was actually in charge of the corporatization of the SABC. In fact, Mr. Peter Matlari had put me in charge of corporatizing the old SABC into SABC Limited. So, I had worked a lot on that. And moving to ICASA, I felt that I could not see things from another angle, from the regulatory part of it. And, ICASA had just been formed at that stage with the merger of the IBA and SETCA into ICASA, and I really felt that I could actually give a lot of input into ICASA from a financial point of view, because it was a new organization. I had a lot of experience in that. Your second question relating to closing of the news bureaus, I think it was a welcome move. From my experience I had been in charge of the news division as well, the finances of the news division. In fact, I was in charge of every division within the SABC in terms of finances. And in fact, I don't think there was a feasibility study done at all on why those news bureaus were opened in the first place. I know we have the SABC's mandate, but a mandate is more national than international. I don't think there ever was a feasibility study done on how we could actually afford it. I know the interim board has actually mentioned that it was actually the budget was 37 million and was already spending over 60 million rand. I mean, so that's for my side, I feel it's actually a fantastic move that what they've done is, and not to have waited for the new board to come in, because we had to put preemptive measures in place to actually stop the slide.
May I just ask your age, and then just your CV? You referred to being medically boarded, your general state of health. That does, maybe you could just indicate that. And then just on your, when you were with the SABC, what did you do to ensure independence of the public broadcaster? You served it a number of years, and at a time when there was obviously a lot of political interference as well. What did you do, and what is your intention now, going forward? It might have been a difficult time then, but how would you ensure that government political parties do not interfere with the public broadcaster? And then thirdly, the whole issue that has come up is, how would you deal with conflicts of interest, both personally and co-members of the board that might have conflicts of interest? How do you think that should be bear in mind? And can I just confirm you're a chartered accountant, is that right? Okay.
Yes, I'm a qualified chartered accountant. I qualified in 1984. My first board attempt. I'm actually 51 years old. I've actually got a neuromuscular disease called Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, which actually results in me getting my legs and arms getting lame. It's not a debilitating disease. You just have to go into hospital every 6 months for a 5-day treatment, and then that controls my symptoms. So it's not, I was medically boarded 5 years ago, and to keep myself busy, I was too young to not do anything, and that's when I decided. In fact, I started serving on the boards of audit committees in 2001, when I started the SABC, where Mr. Peter Matlari gave me the permission to actually do that. So I actually continued that, and I actually want to continue with that. Your second question was? independence.
Independence and conflicts of interest, those two issues.
Independence, in fact, when I was at the SABC, I mean, I wasn't involved in having to deal with those issues. I mean, I was a backroom boy looking at the finances, making sure that the SABC was viable, you know, and we could actually afford the programming that we put on. So, I mean, at that stage, I didn't have to worry about the independence that much. That's what I would have to worry now. I mean, now the independence would be, if we put onto the board, it would be actually critical that the SABC is deemed to be independent of in fact, the SABC is actually regarded as just look worldwide, they regard the SABC as a state broadcaster, even though the SABC only gets 3% of its funding from the SABC, so from government. But the independence, I think what the discussion paper, Department of Communications is busy with the discussion document, and that discussion document will actually spell out the charter of the SABC and will actually then even indicate, you know, how the minister deals with the board, how the board deals with the Department of Communications, deals with CASA, deals with the portfolio committee, and that's when the independence will actually have to be entrenched in those new regulations. Dealing with conflicts of interest, well, I wouldn't have any conflicts of interest personally, because I'm medically boarded. I'm only serving mostly government departments in my audit committees. The only one I'm not, which is outside the audit, which is outside government, is I'm actually on the disciplinary panel of the Southern Institute of Chartered Accountants, where we actually look at members who actually do not obey, where we actually discipline them. So that's the only one out of government that I'm sitting on. And dealing with conflicts of interest of other board members, I mean, that's very clear in terms of the new King 3, where it actually specifies that people who have conflicts of interest, I mean, at every board meeting, we have to specify what conflicts there are. At every meeting, you actually have to say what interest you have in the discussion, and you have to recuse yourself if any decisions have to be taken on that.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Mr. Muller. My question, in some quarters, there are people who are saying let's privatize SABC, and others are saying no, let the government increase its funding. What's your view on that? Do you prefer the privatization of SABC or the government increase its funding and things like that? The second question, in your opening statement, you've mentioned that you've been part of the SABC as an employee. And now, if we decide to appoint you, you'll be coming as a board member. How will you manage that conflict of interest? Because you still have some friends in the SABC or some enemies in the SABC and things like that. How will you manage that conflict of interest?
Thanks, Chair. The first question regarding funding, whether the SABC should be privatized. I do not believe that the SABC must be privatized. I mean, it's a public broadcaster. Nowhere in the world, in fact, you must have a public broadcaster wherever you are, whichever state you are in. I mean, that's the only way you actually, the public broadcaster has different, it serves a different audience and different needs from a commercial broadcaster. Commercial broadcaster is purely profit-driven, whereas the public broadcaster has got special needs. We're actually a developing state, and we've got, many needs that we actually need, especially education, health, where we actually need to impart education on AIDS, HIV/AIDS. And in terms of your question on funding-wise, I would actually suggest a hybrid model for the SABC of 60% funding. I would suggest a 60% funding by the state, 20% coming from commercial activities and 20% plus minus coming from television licenses. At the moment, I think the television licenses comes about between 15 and 17%, but I think that can be actually managed better and more efficiently if it's actually moved out of the SABC into a, I would think, rather, in fact, it's been done elsewhere overseas as well, where it actually becomes a tax, moves to SARS, and SARS then implements the TV licenses. A conflict of interest. Chair, I've been actually out of the SABC for 8 years. I mean, I serve the SABC in a number of departments, so there are still a lot of people who I mean, the SABC has got people who will be there till retirement. I mean, the enemies I would have made would be, I would have made enemies if I didn't approve the overseas trips, or if I didn't approve the. So, I mean, that's a normal course of business for any finance officer, where you actually, but those are not, it's not major for me. I mean, that whichever organization I've worked in, I've had to deal with that. Friends-wise, I mean, I don't have personal, I mean, I've worked with lots of people. I mean, I've worked with, with people who are still in key positions, like, for instance, Charlotte Mampani. I mean, the two of us ran radio division together, but, I mean, there would be no conflict if I had to become a board member. I mean, I would deal with her as any other person.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good day, Mr. Mullah. I'm sitting right in front of you. you know of all the troubles and problems at the SABC, and maybe you've got your own views in which manner all the problems developed and what the reasons was, maybe a wrong decision taken at certain stages. And if you look at the SABC, maybe you know it's a top-heavy structure. There's too many, too less Indians and too many chiefs, if I may use that that word in a good manner. Where will you start as member of the board to rectify all the wrong decisions that were made in the past?
In fact, you talk of being top heavy. In fact, I've looked at the Broadcasting Act, the amended Broadcasting Act, and the Broadcasting Act says that the group executive should be the three members, were, the executive directors plus 11 other members, should be a total of 14. But when I read the annual report of last year, of 2008, they actually got 20 people on the group exec. So they actually already in that's a corporate governance issue, which I don't know why the Auditor General hasn't picked it up, or the previous board hasn't picked up, but that should have been picked up, with that's in contravention of the Broadcast Act. But what does actually very specific on that is actually maximum of 14. You can actually have less than 14. So the top heavy, definitely I agree with you. It's very, very top heavy. In terms of where we should be starting, I mean, the interim board has already started on lots of the things that we should be starting on. For instance, the news division. The news division went way above its budget. There was actually no control of the news costs. I think they gave the previous head of news carte blanche in terms of opening bureaus and not controlling the costs. I looked at the annual report for last year. I mean, there was 220 million rand spent on consultants for 1 year alone. I mean, that is, and I mean, I was actually shortlisted. That's when I started going through this report and looking at now where I should be looking at. And 220 million on consultants is a huge amount. So that's the first area I would be looking at, is the use of consultants. In fact, you look at all government departments. That's where we're focusing on all government departments, is less usage of consultants. Again, the staff In fact, when I was at the SABC with Zwelakhe, the first time we actually went for the retrenchment exercise. And last year they actually increased their, or the last 2 years, they increased their staff complement from 3,500 to 4,100, 600 in 2 years they increased it. I mean, so whatever we had done then, they've undone it now. So that's another one where we actually have to look at this stuff. And then legal costs, where we actually have to control legal costs. I mean, again, there was no limit, no budgetary limits. Even they had a budget, but they never actually bothered to look at the budget on legal costs. And then on the huge amount that they spent on SEP, on the new SEP program. I mean, that from what I've gathered, is that hasn't still been successfully implemented. And then my biggest one of all is the, from my experience with, when I ran the television stations where I used to actually do the scheduling of the programs. But now the scheduling of the programs is not with the television stations anymore. It's sitting in a hub, a content hub, and they buy the programs and they fill the schedules. And no way in the world does that happen. The TV stations know exactly what they want. They should be telling the content hub, I want this program for prime time, and you can buy that program for me. Not the other way around, where they won't buy it and they fill the schedule. So those are the big ones that I would actually be looking at. Okay, I don't remember you.
Thanks, Mr. Muller. I have a question about, I have a few more questions about your remarks on the funding model at the SABC. You mentioned the 60-20-20 funding model. What is your opinion about how the government-funded section of that 60% should be procured? And do you have any opinion or any ideas about the potential for, you know, unnecessary political influence that might result from that kind of funding model? And then I see from your CV that you worked under Peter Mahlale. Now, there are some who believe that his tenure, which was, you know, very fiscally good, didn't give much voice to the needs, the public service mandate of the SABC. I'd like to know what your opinion about that is, and whether you think that those really were the halcyon days of the SABC, if there were things that, you know, didn't chime with what you think the SABC should be about. Just a few, you know, remarks about that. Thank you.
Let me touch on that one first, your Peter Mahlale issue. Peter came in with a clear focus on revenue generation. So he came in with more a commercial, because he came from Prime Media, he came with a more commercial intent. He actually came in at a time when SABC had taken a bit of a dip, and he pushed the SABC again, moving away from the public service into more of the commercial, where that's where you actually saw the big profits, 700 million rand profits with Peter being there. And I mean, after Peter left, it actually, the pendulum swung the other way. So, you know, but you had definitely in under Peter's tenure, the public service obligations took a edge up. So, you know, we actually didn't do what we should have done in terms of public service broadcasting at that stage.
Kaveen, I suppose my question is, what's your view on the tension between those two? Can the SABC be profitable and fulfill its public service mandate, and if so, how?
Definitely. I mean, especially, you know, I'm looking at this, the funding mix. I mean, because we don't expect government to fund the SABC fully, but that's when, again, you're going to come with your tensions between government and the SABC. As I say, we actually get a hybrid SABC where we actually had, you know, the 2020-60 formula. But just to rephrase your question again.
Your view about the tension between the SABC's commercial interest and its public service mandate. How do you think that tension can be managed? Can it be profitable and fulfill its mandate according to the
you know, effectively, if, as you say, under Peter Matlala, it didn't necessarily do so? Is it possible to do both, and how?
Yeah, what I'm saying, we must actually have a cap on the commercial revenue of the SABC. We must actually cap it at 20%. So, in fact, in Australia, they've actually got a cap as well in Australia, where the CEO actually exceeded the cap, and he was fired because of that. So we should. That's how you're going to actually manage attention, because the SABC is a viable broadcaster, and it can, and to actually take away some of the attention, that's why I actually say you actually allow the SABC to retain 20% of its commercial of commercial revenue. And in terms of you actually asked the question of where we should be getting the fund. The funding should come from National Treasury. It should be actually part of the budget vote in Parliament, and it should be voted every year for the SABC. Where SABC has to be like any other government department, where actually has to motivate to the budget committee in October and get funding through that. And then, I mean, the political tensions, that will be sorted out through the charter. I mean, again, in fact, one of the members earlier asked of how the independence, that must be part of the charter. In fact, the discussion document is actually trying to deal with that at the moment.
Question, Mr. Kulwani? Is it a question? Sorry, Ms. Killian and Mr. Kulwani, last question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just wanted to follow up. What is your view, bearing in mind that you need to create some incentives, but we've seen huge bonuses in recent years, on what basis should that be controlled adequately to make sure that there are real measurable outcomes on which basis bonuses should be paid? Because it could be questioned that a body such as the SABC, which was already fighting for its financial survival, could pay out those triple-million bonuses to some of the senior officials. That's my first question. The second one, what is your view on the fact that the current the appointment of key vacancies are currently taking place for people to those positions? Group CEO and the other one, the head of news. And that obviously has an impact on accountability. We've seen in recent years huge tension between the executive and the non-executive component of the board. Do you think that's a good thing, or would you rather have seen the process halted so that you could be part of that to ensure accountability within the board? The concern is budget over expenditure and all of that. So if you could answer that. The last thing, the matter of conflict of interest. I'm not going to refer to the board. You've already responded to that. But of senior management is in the SABC, doing business with the SABC. Do you believe it's good enough for those who are employed on specific packages to just recuse themselves and still conduct business? Or what is your view on that? Should they altogether simply accept payment from the SABC for full-time occupation, and also refrain from being nominated on all sorts of boards which take them out of the office?
Sorry, Chair, so there's three questions. Your first question was on the bonuses.
Yeah.
We actually have to have, in fact, the SABC is a unique animal, where we have to attract the right type of people as well. So it's going to be important for us to attract key people and actually retain them. But the bonuses should not be based on profitability. Should be actually based on outcomes. Like, for instance, if are they meeting the mandates set out by ICASA? In fact, there should be studies, research done on viewership, whether viewership is, happy with whatever the SABC is delivering. So, in fact, it shouldn't be just based. In fact, the past what was happening is it was just based on performance, financial performance, and so it shouldn't be financially driven. It should be actually go wider and look at performance, overall performance of the SABC, and base bonuses on that, and not these massive amounts as you're referring to as well. That was the first question. The second question was?
second question related to the appointment of key positions by the interim board.
In fact, Chair, I actually feel that we actually cannot waste time in waiting for the new board to actually come on board and then filling those key positions. The SBC is a vital national asset, and I mean, I actually have the fullest confidence in the interim board, and I mean, they are very good people on that board, and my view is that they actually should fill those positions as soon as possible. And the third question was on the conflict of interest of senior management, not on board management. On senior management, or in fact on any, I wouldn't even take it just to senior management, I would take it to any level of SBC staffing. They should have no interest in any involved business dealings with the SBC. They should be, in fact, I know the Public Service Commission is going towards that as well, but that should apply to the SBC as well. They should be, in fact, they shouldn't have where they just recuse themselves. Because they should be, I mean, they're employed full-time by the SBC, and they should be employing all the hours should be just going for the SBC.
Thanks, Chairperson. In relation of the Broadcasting Act, the interim board has got the full powers, like the board. That's the legislation which is provided. So it assumes that they can take any decision at their disposal so that they dispense with the matter in front of them. Chair, Mr. Moore, one question. Do you have a TV set?
Yes.
If you do, do you pay your TV license? Then.
Mr. Polwani, that I paid my TV license before I was actually nominated to the board last week. I actually got an email in the post to say the postal strike is on, pay your TV license, and I paid my TV license already the previous week. I used to get a concession. I was an SBC, I used to get a concession, I used to pay 40 Rand a year. So now I don't get a concession, I pay 250 Rand. So.
Alright, Mr. Ullah, thank you very much for your time. I think there are no further questions, and thanks for your participation in the interviews. Can we call in Mr. Kenneth Harold? Members, we're just having a bit of difficulties. Zubo has been trying to contact Mr. Zola Fitlani. His cell phone is off, he's not answering calls, but when they phoned his place of employment, they say he's at work, but he's not taking the calls. So we're going to try again, but I think that we might not be getting a proper response from the person, because he's not traveling, he's at work, am I right? So I think we just need to keep that in mind, and we're going to make one more effort. And then we'll get Lugo to come and report, and we'll have to take a decision. Sorry to have kept you waiting. I know you were here very early this morning, but we. Running a little bit late. Fortunately, one person is not coming, so that's why these members are taking so much of time to ask all the questions. Very welcome. You're very welcome to the committee meeting. The interview will last about 40 minutes or so. You'll speak between 3 and 5 minutes to your CV. Just take us through highlights of your career. And then tell us why you think you are a worthy candidate to be appointed on the board. And then open it up to the members for questions, and I know lots of questions will come your way. Over to you. Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I have to start at the beginning. I was born in Sari, which is now Mpumalanga. At the time, it was called the Eastern Transvaal. And I lived in Sari for a number of years, and I started schooling there. at some stage, my parents realized that schooling, especially in Savi, wasn't up to scratch, and they moved me to Nell Street, where I started schooling there for quite a number of years. But then things started getting a little bit rough, and I think I also started getting into the wrong company at school, started doing things that were not really appreciated, especially by my father. Who then arranged for me to be sent abroad, and I went to England at an age which was roughly about 11 at the time, and I went and stayed with my father's friend. It was quite enjoyable to some extent, except that I found that my father's friend was stricter than my own parents. I mean, there's a lot of things they wouldn't let me do, and I was becoming a little bit of a young man. And anyway, eventually I moved out and went into a student's hostel. At this stage, I had just entered university. So I stayed in the student's hostel. And I think, looking back, I mean, that was really the best part of my life, I think, that student's hostel life. It brought a lot of self-imposed discipline, as opposed to discipline which was thrust upon you. And at the hostel, I met a lot of people from different parts of the world, and really my view started to grow as far as the world was concerned. After some while, just cut the story a little bit short, after a while I got married. And my father wasn't very, very impressed with my getting married at the time, because he said that was not the reason why he had sent me abroad. But nonetheless, I got married. And the result of all that is that my father then cut me off, and he didn't want to have anything to do with me anymore, especially since my marriage had indicated to him that I had no intention of ever coming back to South Africa, because mine was a mixed marriage. I'm sure you understand what I mean by that. And my father thought that by getting married the way that I did, I had actually sent a message to him and to South Africa generally that I was never coming back to South Africa, because the law would not allow me. And from then on, I became my own man, and I did all sorts of things, some of them right, I think, but a lot of them were wrong, I'm sure. This eventually culminated me being invited to Zambia when Zambia became independent. And I went to Zambia as a technician and stayed there for quite a number of years. One thing led to another. I initially went to Zambia on a three-year contract, and my wife agreed that we would only go to Zambia for 3 years. But after 3 years, I found that the program that I had prepared to carry out in Zambia had not been fulfilled in the 3 years that I was contracted. I then agreed to stay for another 3 years in Zambia, and my wife then was not very, very happy with that decision, because we had agreed that we were only going to Zambia for 3 years. Anyway, I then renewed my contract for another three, that was 6 years in total, and my wife stayed on. But then when that 6 years expired, I really was right in the middle of doing all sorts of wonderful things, I thought, in Zambia. I then decided to renew my contract for a further 3 years. It was at that stage that my wife thought, no, this is it, enough. So she packed up and left. That's the Zambian story. But after that, I then ended up in Zimbabwe, where I worked and became eventually assistant to the chief engineer. And I thoroughly enjoyed Zimbabwe very, very much. It was during that time when Mandela was released, and I saw that, you know, there was a very strong possibility that I might eventually come back to South Africa. And my answer was, my hopes were answered in that I was headhunted by the Transkei Broadcasting Corporation, who needed a chief engineer to start a new broadcasting house which had just been built. And that, to me, seemed a tremendous challenge. In all my technical life, I had always joined broadcasting institutions that were already running. But here, I found in Transkei was an empty house, an empty broadcasting house, which I was to equip and put all the necessary equipment in there, and which I did. I found it terribly challenging, especially at the time I also met the head of state, you know, who captivated me. And I must just tell you a short little story about my head of state in Transkei. When I first went to Transkei, I left my family back in Zimbabwe, and incidentally I had remarried again by this time. And when I went by Transkei Airways to the airport where I was to catch the Zambia Airways back to Zimbabwe, I realized after the plane had landed that the head of state of my Transkei new country